Well, I do want to welcome you this morning to the story. If you're new joining us with this, we are on a journey using the book, The Story. It's not a replacement for the Bible. It's a compilation of scriptural references that are put in chronological order. So it's a tool to use. It's a reference tool to use, but isn't a replacement for the scriptures themselves. But it's our hope that as we go through this, that you're going to connect a little bit more with your lower story and with God's upper story and how these two kind of come together. And so far, we've looked at Adam and Eve. We've looked at Noah and Abraham. And today, we're going to look at the story of Joseph. But before we turn to Genesis 37, which is where our story starts off in our scripture this morning, I'm wondering if any of you have ever read one of those Choose Your Own Adventure books that were really popular in the 80s, especially. Yeah, I had a series of those things. I loved them because you could read along and then your character would come to some decision they had to make. And if you liked one decision, you could turn to page 74. And if you wanted to choose something else, you had to turn to page 93. And you got to choose the adventure that you were on. It's kind of fun because you could kind of read the book a few different times, choosing different paths. I usually tried to put my hero in the most perilous conditions as possible when I first read it, and then I would use some more conservative things later. I think that we like these stories. They're kind of taking a real comeback right now with kids, but I think the reason why we like these stories is because we feel like life should be that way. We feel like life should be something where we get to choose our own adventure. But one of the things that you're going to discover as you live life is that a lot of life happens to you regardless of your choices, regardless of what you would want to have happen. I think if I asked you today, if you're doing the kind of work or the kind of job that you said you would do when you were in kindergarten, how many of you are doing that work today? A couple of you? All right. Now see, when I was a kindergartner, I'm certainly not doing any of that work. In fact, being a pastor was not even, I don't think it was in the top 50 if I had even made a list. At this point, I should be like a star firefighter or maybe a police chief with two big guns or maybe a race car driver, preferably NASCAR. That would have been one of my dreams, but never came true because life happened and things went differently than I had anticipated them to go. And I think for most of us, life doesn't always take the exact path that we plan and it takes us in a different direction. Well, this character, Joseph, that we're going to look at has had some dreams, literal dreams. But life didn't go exactly the way that he had thought either. In fact, it takes some pretty big twists and turns. In fact, life might, what you'd say, woke him up to a different reality. So if you open up to Genesis chapter 37, I want to tell you a little bit about the story before we jump into some of the scriptures here. But Joseph is the son of who? Who's his father? Jacob, very good. And one of Jacob's other names is Israel. So Jacob, who is also renamed Israel later, has these sons. How many sons did he have altogether? 12, right. Joseph is second from the youngest. Benjamin is younger than him. The other 10 are older than he is. So he's kind of a little guy on the totem pole when it comes to his family with 10 older brothers. I can't imagine what life is like with 10 older brothers. He definitely grew up in what we would call a very dysfunctional home. Maybe that's because there were 12 boys in the house. I'm not really sure. But he holds a rather unique position in the family because out of the 12 sons that Jacob has, he decides that Joseph is his favorite of the 12. And he shows this favoritism by giving him this coat of many colors. And Joseph kind of gets out of the hard labor work, but the rest of the boys have to do the hard labor. Jacob, for whatever reason, has decided that Joseph is his favorite, and he wants to show that favoritism. Now, when Jenny and I are doing Christmas for the kids and we're buying gifts for the kids, we have to always make sure that we have just the right amount of gifts and that there's fairness and equality amongst our four kids. If there's not equality, someone's going to claim that there was favoritism. Now, the truth of the matter is that we do like one of our kids more than the others. That's actually not true. Can you imagine a parent saying that, though? Can you? And now maybe you have your favorite. Please keep it a secret. But can you imagine a parent communicating to the rest of the kids, "I like this one better than the rest of you"? How do you think those other siblings might treat that one? Yeah, as my aunt would say, not too good. In fact, in Genesis 37:4, it says this: when his brothers saw that their father loved him, that is Joseph, more than any of them, they hated him and couldn't speak a kind word to him. I think it's very difficult when we find ourselves growing up in a home environment where there is harsh words and criticism instead of love and encouragement. In fact, I might say for a child, that's one of the most difficult environments to have to grow up in. A home like that has a way of crushing the dreams of children and kind of kills the spirit of those that live under that suffering or that suppression. This is what it was like for Joseph in his home. He had these older brothers, the one younger, but nobody seemed to like him. It wasn't his fault that he was his father's favorite, but they took it out on him because he was. Now, Joseph had a dream, and the scriptures tell us about this dream that he had. And in this dream, all of his other brothers, the 11 brothers, bowed down to Joseph. Okay? Now, if you're taking notes this morning, this will be an important part, an important note I want you to take. If you ever have a dream in which your siblings bow down to you, keep that information to yourself. Okay? It's not going to be helpful or beneficial for you to share that with others. Joseph, of course, shares it with all of his other brothers. I don't know what he was expecting would be the outcome of that, but they weren't too happy about it. In fact, in Genesis chapter 37, verses 19 and 21, and on the scriptures here too, I'll tell you some of the places where they are in the storybook if you're following along with that as well. It'll be the bottom of page 29. His brothers say this: "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." So the brothers are not too happy about this this dreamer boy. And they can see him coming off in the distance. They're all in the field working, but not Joseph. He's just, heading on out. Da, 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 da. And they see him in the distance, and they decide they're going to do away with this guy. But a couple of his brothers, Reuben and then specifically his brother Judah, decides that they shouldn't kill him, and he proposes a different plan. You'll find this in the middle of page 30. It's Genesis 37, 26 through 27. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood." And his brothers agreed. What do you notice about the word Ishmaelites? That's right. It's in the succession, it's Abraham. His when they decided to do their own plan instead of God's plan, they brought a different woman, Hagar, into the relationship, and she had a son, and that was Ishmael. So the Ishmaelites are from that other clan that came out of this disobedience of Abraham and Sarah. So they decide that they're going to sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites instead of kill him. This, of course, preserves the line of the 12 tribes of Israel, because Israel, of course, being the father, Jacob, his name is Israel, the 12 sons become the 12 tribes. So when you say the 12 tribes of Israel, a lot of times we think of that as a national statement, but it's the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 sons of Jacob. And so it preserves this. So, sure enough, they sell him into slavery. They get a little spending cash as a result. So at age 17, which is how old Joseph is at this point, he's taken to a foreign land. And the Ishmaelites take him all the way to Egypt, and they sell him there to one of Pharaoh's officials. In fact, it's a man named Potiphar. And Potiphar is the captain of the Pharaoh's bodyguards. So, you know, the Pharaoh, who is the top person, political person in Egypt, he had a bodyguard that followed him around, and Potiphar is the captain of that bodyguard. He purchases Joseph and has him as a slave. Now, in the meantime, the brothers take Joseph's coat of many colors. They rip it up, they dip it in goat's blood, and they bring it back to Jacob. And they show Jacob, they say, sorry, Dad, we were on a stroll, animal ate your son, and it's really bad. And Jacob breaks down in tears. He wails, he goes into mourning. He's just so broken up that his favorite son has been killed by this wild animal, whatever it might be. Then meanwhile, back in Egypt, we have Joseph working as a slave for Potiphar. But Potiphar sees something unique in Joseph. In fact, he sees that he has some leadership skills, he has some administrative abilities, and it doesn't take long before Potiphar takes Joseph and moves him from the position of just a slave to a slave that has total control over his company, his bodyguard company. And the scriptures tell us that while Joseph was running the company, that Potiphar didn't have anything to worry about, that Joseph took care of everything, and he was successful in what he did because of Joseph's administration over all of this. So even though Joseph is a slave, he has worked himself up to at least the best position he could get under his master Potiphar. But you see, Joseph didn't just attract the attention of Potiphar. He also attracted the attention of Potiphar's wife. Now, to use modern terminology to get an idea of what Potiphar's wife was like, she was a cougar. Okay? If you don't know what a cougar is, maybe it'll make sense in just a few moments, but she would have been one of the desperate housewives types of individuals. She is interested in Joseph in a way that Potiphar is not interested. Are we speaking the same language here? Understand what I mean? In fact, the Hebrew word that is used to say, come to bed with me, is a Hebrew word that is a very strong expletive. It is not those words. I can't find a translation that will treat that word honestly because it is so profane. This is a dirty thing that she is saying, and she's trying to entice him to be with her. But Joseph refuses. And he has to refuse time and time again of Potiphar's wife. I do find it interesting because I look at Joseph's life and I see a lot of disappointment. You know, here he was his father's favorite son, and since then it's been disappointment after disappointment. And it seems like when people are disappointed in things, they tend, as followers of God, they tend to take it out on God. They start to feel disobedient to God because God has somehow let them down. And this happens in our life, but it's interesting. There's been some studies done that for a lot of Christians, when they feel like God has let them down, not only do they become disobedient, but it usually manifests itself in some kind of a sexual sin. And they don't know why this is. They don't know why that's kind of the bent that we go to, but it's what the studies are kind of showing. There was a study done of single people. And this is single people kind of in general, who are looking for a mate, looking for someone to marry, but haven't found that person yet. And as they get more and more discouraged with this because they're not comfortable with where they're at or the place that God has them at the moment, as they're looking for this, they said, what is the number one temptation that you struggle with? And 90% of the respondents, men and women, said sexual sin of some sort, one way or another, which to me says the other 10%, their number one issue must have been lying. It's a big deal. And it doesn't just happen with our singles. It happens with people who are married as well. Maybe there's a wife who's not felt genuine love from her husband in years. She no longer feels like he notices her or he cares. And so it's easy to flirt at the office or reconnect with an old boyfriend over email. Maybe it's a husband who's married to a woman that makes intimacy with him seem like a trip to the dentist for a filling. He finds himself going online and looking at what he knows he shouldn't look for, but he justifies it because he says, I have needs, and he poorly deals with his disappointments. Look, Joseph's story is not going as he planned it to go. But Joseph continues to resist Potiphar's wife's advancements. In fact, he says this in Genesis 39, verses 8 through 9, the bottom of page 31. But he refused her again. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? The human side of me that doesn't understand or want to be obedient to what I think God calls me to at times, it looks at this passage, and I can't believe that Joseph says what he says here. He says, how can I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And I think, against God, what about what God has done to Joseph? I mean, Joseph doesn't deserve what he's going through. God is putting him through all of this. And if I were Joseph, I don't know if I could be strong enough to look at my situation and have that kind of perspective. I think I would look at this situation, I would think, you know, God is the one that has disappointed me. And I would think I would find myself possibly being disobedient as a result. I mean, think of this. I mean, Joseph is never going to get married as a slave. And yet he has this woman who is attracted to him, who is luring him, and he doesn't take the fruit. Well, talk about disappointment. Joseph does resist Potiphar's wife, but at another point in time, she makes another advance on him, but this one the strongest yet. She grabs a hold of him, and he gets out of her grasp and kind of, you know, weasels out of her hands, but what he leaves behind is his coat. And he takes off because he is not going to fall into this. But what does Potiphar's wife do? She takes the coat and she sets up a scene that looks like rape. And she cries rape. And they haul Joseph in before Potiphar, and Potiphar throws him into jail, throws him into prison. And the prisons didn't have cable TV, and you didn't get 3 square meals a day. I mean, this is a dungeon kind of a setting. You got chains on you. And here Joseph finds himself disappointed yet again with something that he did not do, something that he is not guilty of. Joseph is in prison for a crime he did not commit. He's become a slave, and disappointment seems to follow him and his story. Joseph did nothing to bring this on himself. He didn't bring it on himself as Adam and Eve brought their sin upon themselves. Or he didn't do it like Abraham and Sarah did when they brought another woman into the relationship. Joseph is innocent. He's at the mercy of other people's decisions. And I think it begs one question. Where is God in all of this? Some of you may be in this chapter of your life right now as well and asking the question, where is God in my situation? Maybe it's been disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. And you're wondering, where is God? Does he even hear me? Does he even know? Does he care? I can remember being a child about 13 years old, and I had gone through multiple situations that were disappointing to me. And a lot of them had to do with Christian people. And I remember being so disillusioned by the church and by Christian people and the whole idea of Christianity that I knelt at the side of my bed and I said to God, God, I don't know where you are, I don't know who you are, I don't know what you're up to, but I hate what my life is turning into, I hate what I see around me, and if you're real, you need to show yourself to me because I'm done with this. And I said amen, being done, and you know what? The skies didn't part. Jesus didn't show up in my room. I gave up. I quit. I was going through a season of such discouragement when it came to my faith. And if this morning you're asking that question as well, I want to give you some hope. Because where is God for the family that loses a young mother to breast cancer? Where is God in the family for the man who loses his job and is the only source of income for the family? Where is God for the family who loses a child to a drunk driver? Where is God? top of page 31 at Genesis 39:2, it says this: the Lord was with Joseph. That's where he was. He was with Joseph. May not seem like it, but he was there. The Lord was there with Joseph, and the Lord is here right now in your situation. You may ask him, where is he? Feel that he's distant from you, but he's not. Because just like with Joseph, the Lord is also with us. I think there's a little silver lining here for Joseph. You know, Joseph escaped death when he got thrown into that cistern because of his brother Judah. But the same point here, one of the jobs of the captain of the bodyguards was also the job of chief executioner. Potiphar could have had Joseph executed. In fact, that probably would have been a normal punishment for what he did to Potiphar. But Potiphar throws him into jail instead of executing him. I wonder why. Just speculation, but could it be that maybe Potiphar got wind of his wife's cougar ways? Maybe he was fully aware of what kind of person she was. And he had to save face, but at the same point, to spare Joseph's life. I mean, Joseph's life is spared with his brothers, and it gets spared again here in this situation. But now that he's in prison, the warden starts to notice Joseph and starts to see the exact same things that Potiphar had noticed in Joseph. And eventually he's put in charge of the actual prison itself. Just amazing. Genesis 39:23 on the middle of page 32. It says, the warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Again, how it says here, the Lord was with Joseph. Now, there's two prisoners there with Joseph. One is a baker and one's a cupbearer. The professions, the baker, it's obvious, he was a baker. The cupbearer, though, a little bit of a unique job. We don't really have those today, at least in our culture. But a cupbearer was a person that was hired by an influential person who maybe was concerned that their life might be at risk from some kind of assassination attempt. And so the cupbearer, their job was to drink out of the cup of whoever the person was they were protecting in case someone laced the cup or laced the beverage with a poison of some sort. Now, it was kind of a good news, bad news job because the good news was as long as no one was trying to assassinate your boss through beverage, you got the first taste of the finest of wines and the finest of beverages. But the bad news is that when you took that sip, everyone in the room just stared at you, waiting to see if you're going to keel over or not. And, you know, if you do your job well, you could end up dead. Cupbearers would kind of, you know, no pun intended, but they would come and go. But this cupbearer finds himself in prison. We're not told why. But both the cupbearer and the baker have these dreams. And they have these dreams, and they don't know what they mean. And God gives Joseph the ability to interpret the dreams. And so he interprets the dreams for both of these guys, and exactly as Joseph said in the interpretation, the dreams come true. And you read this text, and as you read it, and it's all said and done, the story's over, you kind of feel like, what in the world was that in there for? Why would we care about Joseph interpreting the dreams of a cupbearer and a baker? In fact, the dreams are kind of, sadistically funny, I guess. If you're interested, please go to the scriptures and read about those dreams. They are very interesting. But we kind of give the so what question to it. Well, what happens is that later on, cupbearer gets out of prison. And he finds himself in the top cupbearer position. He is the cupbearer for Pharaoh himself. And Pharaoh is going through a real dilemma because he has a dream. And he can't make sense of his dream. And his dream is crazy. It's got cows in it and skinny cows and heads of wheat and then wheat and cows are eating each other. I mean, it's a really weird dream. And he keeps telling this dream to people and nobody can tell him what it means. And he brings all the people around him that are supposed to be able to interpret dreams and no one can interpret it. And of course, the cupbearer is there and he's hearing some of this conversation. And you kind of get the sense as you read the text that the cupbearer goes, hey, wait a minute. there's this guy. He was in prison with me. He interpreted one of my dreams and it came true. His name is, you know, Joey or something. But you got to find this guy. And sure enough, Pharaoh calls for Joseph to come from the prison. He tells him the dream, and God gives Joseph the ability right then and there to interpret the dream. And he interprets in the dream that there is going to be 7 years of bumper crops for Egypt. And after that, there's going to be 7 years of the toughest drought and famine they've ever experienced. And Pharaoh is so impressed with Joseph. I'm sure he probably talked to Potiphar. He probably talked to the warden. He knows the skill sets that Joseph has. And he says this in Genesis 41, 38 through 41, the bottom of page 33. So Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made this all known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Well, for a slave, Joseph has finally arrived. He went from a pit in the ground to the deputy pharaoh in Egypt, the vice president's spot. And sure enough, for the next 7 years, they had bumper crops. And what Joseph did with his administrative skill sets is he stocked it away. He piled it up. The crops would come in more than anybody could handle, and he would take the excess and he would stock it away. And when the 7 years of drought came, Egypt had enough food to feed its people and to feed the outlying countries as well. In fact, the famine was widespread. It had reached all the way to Canaan, where Jacob and the other 11 brothers were. And they had money, but they didn't have any food to buy. And they heard about Egypt having all this extra food and that they could go there and they could purchase it. And so they made the long trip all the way to Egypt. You know who they had to meet with? The deputy pharaoh, Joseph. Now, it had been a long time since they'd seen Joseph. He was 17 last time they saw him. Now he's 39 years old. They don't recognize him. And Joseph kind of puts him through a little test, kind of a quirky little test to make sure that they were really sorry for the things they did to Joseph. It's interesting how he kind of pulls the information out of them. But once he's convinced that they're sorry for what they did, he reveals himself to them as to his true identity, and they embrace each other, and they have this incredible reunion again. But I want you to think through the things that Joseph had to do for God to get him to the place where he was able to save the lives of millions of people. And ultimately, a very important point, ultimately save the lives of his family. Because without Joseph being able to be in that position to stockpile the grain, Jacob and his sons would have died. And that would have been the end of God's nation. It would have ended before it really even got off the ground. Now I want you to see the perspective that Joseph had on all that he went through. He said this to his brothers in Genesis 50, verse 20, which is on the top of page 42. It said, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Joseph is saying, "You know, brothers, you meant to do evil to me. But from the moment you made a decision to sell me into slavery, it was all part of God's plan to get me where I am today, so that I could save your lives and the lives of many people. What you intended for harm, God used for good. What you meant to be bad, God was able to use it for good in the world and in my own life." And I think we have to do a gut check here and really ask ourselves if we believe that this is true for us. Could the hardships that you're going through be something that God can use for good? The book of Romans, chapter 8, verse 28, it says this, "And we know that in all things God works for the good for those who love him, those who have been called according to his purpose." Did you know that God can and does use every event in your life for good? The only catch here in this promise is that it's a promise for those that love God. Joseph stayed faithful through all his trials. He never broke in his faithfulness. And God was able to use every one of those things for good. I'm going to invite our worship team to come up. And we're going to close our service with a particular song, but before we do that, I want you to know something about stories. That when it comes to stories, every single story is the same story. Every story is the same story. And stories are told through the hero, but the hero is just simply the one who lives out the story. This is the framework or the form of a story. Stories are born out of ordinary events, ordinary surroundings, the ordinary world, that which is safe and predictable. In some stories that you might know, this would be the Shire. Or this might be Dorothy's farm in Kansas, or the home that holds the magic wardrobe. But then a story will have an inciting event. Not exciting, but inciting event. Something that barges in, something that interrupts the ordinary. That which without it there would be no story. This might be something like Jaws snacking. That's an inciting event. E.T. missing his ride. Or Buzz Lightyear getting put in Woody's spot on the bed. An inciting event. But all stories are the same. Different characters, different inciting events, different heroes. But it's all the same story. And why is that? I mean, who builds story in the first place? It's God. God builds story. And he loves story. And he uses story. And when we think that this book is a book of rules or instructions, we miss out on the truth that this is a story. And it's a story that we're supposed to connect with. And that it has heroes. And it has villains. And it has all kinds of inciting events that challenge the hero to action. Act one in our story so far has been Adam and Eve. And Cain and Abel. And Noah and the flood. Abraham and Sarah. And as of today, Joseph. All familiar stories that form the foundation of our faith. Stories. And it's in these stories which we find our own story. What is your story? You have your ordinary world, whatever that might be. You've got your own shire or your own farm. But in your life, there's going to become inciting events. For some people, they get invited to church for the first time. Another inciting event might be that you hear about a particular mission trip. And it's just hearing about it is the very beginning. Where you hear about a child who needs a home. And all of a sudden the questions start rattling around in your mind. Sometimes inciting events are things that happen to you. Like you get laid off. Or you find out that lump is malignant. Sometimes inciting events come from tragic mistakes that we make. You have the affair. You get pulled over for a DUI. Your girlfriend says, I'm pregnant. And then there's shame and there's guilt. And with that comes death. But I want you to know that no matter how the inciting event comes, it always demands a response from us. It's a call to an adventure. And when answered, the journey will actually begin for you. I want you to answer the inciting events that come into your life. It is a journey. What does the journey look like? Well, for Moses, the journey involved the deliverance of God's people from slavery in Egypt. God provided the Ten Commandments to deliver his people from lawlessness. God provided manna for his people so that he would deliver his people from starvation. Through Joshua, he delivers his people from invading armies. And I could go on and on about the stories, but the stories of God are always stories about deliverance, about delivering his people from oppression and difficulty and suffering. Every good story is about deliverance of some sort. And God wired you and I for story, so we would be drawn to His story. And in doing so, find our own story. We're going to close our time by singing a song that I really want to be a champion song for us today. It's a song that talks about how God won't ever let us go. That He loves us so much. And whether you find yourself in a difficult chapter of your story right now, you've got to remember God is with you. He has not left you. He has not abandoned you. And maybe you can look at a long line of things that have been negative in your life. And I want you to know that God can use all of that for good for those that love Him. So stay faithful. Don't give up and become disobedient. Stay faithful. It's worth it. Father God, we thank You for Your love for us that reaches out. Lord, a love that can cast out fear. And Lord, help us to be a people that don't fear. Help us to be a people that stay obedient to You in the midst of life's disappointments, and to start to see our disappointments as opportunities for you to do good. And Lord, let us let go of having to see the end product, but to just trust that the promise is true to us, that You can use all things for good for those who love You. Lord, may we take a lesson from the life of Joseph. In the face of life's disappointments, You created something amazing. Lord, as You enter into our stories, as the inciting events happen in our lives, it's my prayer that each one of us will respond to that, that we will start on the journey of our story. Father God, we thank You for Your love for us, a love that we don't deserve, but a love that You offer. And we thank You in Jesus' name. Amen. As you go from here today, it's my encouragement to you to see your life as a story, that you are a hero in this story. And it's up to you on what you do with the events that happen, the decisions that you make. If you need someone to pray with, someone to encourage you, maybe things are just difficult and you need some uplifting and strength, we're always available here. You can call us up, email us, come by. We'd love to pray with you, encourage you in any way we can. God bless you as you go into your week. Thank you for coming. You're dismissed.